The issue of quarantine has become a subject of great controversy recently, with different states formulating different rules and policies, so we've decided to make quarantines the subject of today's edition of Please Explain. What being under quarantine can mean and what the history of quarantine can tell us about how to think about them now in the context of Ebola and other more recent contagious diseases. Joining us is Dr. Howard Markell, the George E. Wants Distinguished Professor and Founding Director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. He serves as the Principal Historical Consultant on Pandemic Preparedness for the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and he's the author of Quarantine, East European Jewish Immigrants and the New York City Epidemics of 1892. Also, When Germs Travel, Six Major Epidemics That Have Invaded America Since 1900 and the Fears That They Have Unleashed. Welcome to our show.
Well, it's great to be here, Leonard.
And we invite our listeners to join in the conversation. You can call us at 212-433-9692. Write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. Also, join in on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. First, Dr. Markell, the terms isolation and quarantine are often used interchangeably, but do they mean the same thing?
No. And isolation refers specifically to the person with the infectious disease, someone who is ill with that infectious disease, and they would be put in a special isolation room today in a hospital to prevent them from infecting others. Quarantine, on the other hand, refers to those who either had direct contact with somebody with a dreaded infectious disease or were suspected of having such contact.
Where did the word quarantine come from?
Well, it's really from Italy. It's an Italian word. It was coined during the Black Plague, the bubonic plague epidemic of the 14th century, the 1370s to be exact. And Venice, which was the major port in the world at that time, really wanted to do something to prevent plague from getting into their port because it would hurt business, frankly. And so they came up with an idea of quarantinaria or quarante giorno, which means 40 days. And that's really where the word quarantine comes from.
And we were just talking to the author of a Mexican cookbook, and she told me as she was leaving that she has a recipe for quarantine broth, a broth that would have a lot of nutritious stuff in it. So I guess quarantine is something that traveled beyond Venice fairly quickly.
Oh, absolutely. And it's, you know, the quarantine, the word is more of an English root, and but that's just the origin of it. And it caught on almost as quickly as germs had caught on.
Well, it's interesting that even though there wasn't a clear understanding of how diseases spread, people had a sense that there might be an incubation period and something should be done.
That is interesting, because if you read the doctors of that day, or even the doctors of the very late 19th century until germ theory was accepted, that certain microbes cause infectious diseases, that was really different from the regular person's understanding. And throughout history, people did understand in some sense certain diseases were catchy, that spread. It was a very easy observation to make during an epidemic. And so most people wanted to be far apart from those who appeared to be infected.
What happens to a person's body during the incubation period when we're not aware that we are ill yet?
Well, that really depends on what virus or bacteria you're infected with. But generally, once you become infected, there can be a short or a long incubation period, and that germ, that microbe, is multiplying within your body in different ways, depending on what type of microbe it is. And then it's multiplying to a level where it actually causes disease, which we would recognize as obvious symptoms. But it really does vary depending on what you're infected with.
And we've heard that the incubation period for Ebola is between 2 and 21 days. That strikes me as a very wide range.
Really confusing, isn't it? And this is based on observations over the last 35 years of handling Ebola infections. And it really reminds me of a much older infection, typhus fever, which is a rickettsial organism that causes that. But in the 1890s, no one really knew what caused it. And you would find incubation time cited as early as 3 or 4 days all the way to 21 days, and even the 21 days was sometimes argued. So we are basing it on our observations with respect to Ebola, and I suspect that might get better information as we go along.
During the incubation period, I guess the disease is spreading within the body.
Right.
And the body is deteriorating as part of the process?
Well, I wouldn't call it deteriorating. You could be absolutely normal, but as more cells become infected, and Ebola is a virus, so viruses they're smaller than bacteria, and they require a living host, whether it's a person or a plant or an animal, and then they're multiplying. And the more they multiply, the more they actually do their dirty work, so to speak, and then finally symptoms develop.
My guest is Dr. Howard Markel, the George E. Wants Distinguished Professor and Founding Director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. We're talking about quarantining on today's Please Explain and taking your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. I am Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC. Let's take a call before we go on with this conversation. Marilyn from New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I called to let you know that I myself was the subject of a quarantine. I'm 64 years old, and when I was born, there were no vaccines against whooping cough, pertussis. And I caught pertussis in Brooklyn, where I grew up in Park Slope, and when I was
it's a dangerous area.
Yes, it could have been at the time. There was an outbreak at the time, and I got the whooping cough because my grandmother had visited a family in the neighborhood where the children had it, and then she came reportedly and picked me up, when she got to our house, and that's how I got it. But anyway, once I was diagnosed, I was brought to Long Island College Hospital and placed in a special isolation ward. And my mother was nursing me at the time. I was only a few months old. And even my mother couldn't pick me up or nurse me. So it was very difficult for her. And then I understand from my mother and father that because I had it, the Board of Health put big orange signs on our windows to say that the house was quarantined. So that's my story.
Well, luckily in your case, Marilyn, you were just an infant, so you don't remember. Stephen Colbert has said that quarantine today for an adult is like waiting for Time Warner Cable to show up. But is there a stigma attached often to quarantine, Doctor?
Well, yes, that's a wonderful story, and then we can talk about childhood diseases later. Fortunately, we do have vaccines, but there almost always is a stigma to those who are quarantined. What we had seen way too often in the past, and hopefully we have evolved beyond this, is that not just the individual who was ill with a quarantinable disease or their family or their friends, but whole classes of people. So when, for example, Russian Jewish immigrants were accused of importing cholera into New York City in the 1890s, all Russian Jews were classed as, infectious or dangerous to others, and it was written up in the newspapers and talked about. And in fact, there was a great Yiddish journalist, Abraham Kahn, who edited the Daily Forward, who was writing in an editorial, I fear for my life that I might be quarantined because I'm a Russian Jew with an upset stomach from eating too much at dinner. So nowadays, there's still a great deal of stigma, but my hope is that we won't stigmatize all Africans, for example, or all healthcare workers.
Nurses right now
are
very upset about that.
Yeah.
Now, when we talk about these things, two other words often come up, epidemic and pandemic. What's the difference?
Well, an epidemic is a number of cases. Demos is Greek for people, and epi refers to the spread. And an epidemic is when you have a number of cases of a disease that you do not expect in a particular place. So For example, one case of Ebola in New York City would be classified as an epidemic, even though there's only this one case with Dr. Duncan right now. But flu, on the other hand, you'd have to have several thousand cases in New York because you do expect flu right around this time. Pandemic means all people, not just some people, but all people. And so that really refers to the spread through many, many countries throughout the world. And that's what we saw in 2009 with the H1N1 influenza pandemic.
Now, influenza and Ebola are both viruses. Are they more likely to cause an epidemic than bacteria?
No, it's not based on virus or bacteria. And in fact, if you didn't have an immunized community, say, in Park Slope today, and pertussis was introduced, you could see a whooping cough epidemic, and that's a bacteria. In influenza, well, because it changes its structure every year and not everyone gets vaccinated against it, it tends to spread as an epidemic as well. But it's very important to note how absolutely differently influenza spreads, and you talked about incubation time when compared to Ebola. So influenza is very easily transmitted. If I were in the same room with you and I had flu, real flu, and I was coughing and sneezing on you, or I shook hands with you after touching a wet handkerchief, you could very easily get flu. And the incubation period for that is about 1 to 4 days. It's very short. Ebola, on the other hand, there has to be contact of one's body fluids. Specifically, somebody is so ill with Ebola, because this is what it causes when you're very ill, that there's vomiting and profuse diarrhea as well as bleeding. And those body fluids have to get into another person's mucous membrane, so the eyes, the mouth, the nose, or potentially a cut if you have one and you're not being protected. So that's not casually transmitted at all.
We've been hearing about the possibility that Ebola might mutate as other things mutate. Flus mutate constantly, don't they? In fact, I heard recently that there are concerns that having the flu vaccine doesn't necessarily protect us if the next invasion of flu is not covered by all the things in the vaccine that we're getting.
Well, that's true, and that's a constant problem because the way flu vaccine is made, because, you know, it takes time to make flu vaccine. It takes 3 to 6 months to make a very large supply of vaccine. And basically, experts are guesstimating which strains are going to be running that year, but they can sometimes be wrong. Viruses always mutate. There's no question about that. And experts at the CDC and WHO and other health groups around the world have surveillance labs all over the world where they measure and look at very closely the antigenic structure and the genetic structure of various flu viruses and now Ebola and many other viruses as well. But
does that mean that it would be hard to develop an Ebola vaccine? I know there are drugs right now being developed to treat it, but a vaccine might only apply to the Ebola of last year or last month?
No, because Ebola is a very different virus and doesn't seem to mutate as quickly as flu, and it doesn't spread as quickly as flu. And one way viruses really like to mutate is that they pass through living beings. But even flu, when they do mutate, they don't mutate on a dime in terms of changing the way they're infectious or transmitted or so on. So there's a fear that Ebola might somehow become a respiratory transmitted disease, and we have no evidence for that. And that's not the highest on my list of things to be concerned about. But you're right, you do have to follow this, and we do.
A caller, Al from Queens, wonders whether, since they do mutate, if we have had the illness and survived, are we immune from it in the future?
Well, with flu, no. Although you can develop some immunity to that specific strain of virus. It doesn't necessarily last for the rest of your life. Because it does change so often, you frequently will get flu more than once in your life. Ebola, we don't have enough experience, frankly, with survivors of Ebola and to see if they've been re-exposed. And we're going to get more information if a vaccine is developed in terms of what populations do and how they respond. But the jury is still out. But that doesn't mean you don't get vaccinated for flu, for example, every year. It's really your best bet. And the thing to remember about influenza, it's not a common cold. Everyone calls every cold the flu. But true influenza makes you really, really sick. And it sets you up for pneumonia, and it sets you up for a number of other problems. And it can be deadly. 35,000 people will die in America, most likely. It might be 40,000, it might be 30,000, but they will die of flu this year.
And the Spanish flu killed a lot more worldwide.
Absolutely. That was the 1918 flu. It was an H1N1 flu. And there was something really special and novel about that flu that made it particularly deadly, not just to very young people or to very old people, which is generally the target of flu deaths, but to young adults who were about 15 to 35 or 40. And it had a case fatality rate of about 2.5 to 3%, depending on what location you're looking at. In fact, in some countries, it was as high as 10%. And the average case fatality rate for a seasonal flu, regular garden variety flu, is about 0.07%. So it's very small in comparison to the, you know, tens of millions of people who died around the world of the 1918 flu.
Wasn't one of the reasons young people died because they hadn't lived long enough to have developed certain immunities just from the environment?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And in fact, those young people were not immune to that particular strain. But it was rather novel. So not a lot of human beings, whether they were, you know, 0 or 100, had immunological experience against that. There were other issues as well. You know, it's the beginning of World War I, at least in the American side. And there were, you know, tens of thousands of servicemen who were living cheek by jowl in camps, and then in trains, and then in boats, and then in foxholes. So these young men were really prey for the flu in 1918 as well.
My guest is Dr. Howard Markel, the George E. Wants Distinguished Professor and Founding Director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. He serves as the Principal Historical Consultant on Pandemic Preparedness for the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. Or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we'll be back with more of today's Please Explain right after this. And we are back with Dr. Howard Markel, who's written a number of books about quarantine. He is the George E. Wants Distinguished Professor and Founding Director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan and serves as the Principal Historical Consultant on Pandemic Preparedness for the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Yesterday, Dr. Markel, a Maine judge confined the nurse Casey Hickox to her house. She had treated Ebola victims but shows no sign of the disease herself. The judge has reversed himself, but Hickox must still submit to daily monitoring and coordinate her travel with state officials. What do you make of that level of monitoring and the media circus around her?
Well, those are two very different issues. I think the monitoring, the temperature monitoring, is not that onerous and probably a good idea. It's very unlikely.
But they don't want it even get within 3 feet of somebody else.
Well, you know, it is interesting about that, and that may be a little bit overkill. You know, the idea of voluntary self-quarantine would have gone a much longer way, I think, and that cow left the barn long before she got back home to Maine. It started in Newark. But on the other side of the fence, and, you know, look, Miss Hickox is a hero and a superb nurse, and I do not know her, nor can I judge her. But on the other side, there is this media circus. the bike ride yesterday and all that. And one of the things that I have been thinking about is that, you know, doctors and nurses and other health professionals, we allay fear and quell panic all the time. We do this with our patients on an individual basis, and we do this with families, and we do this writ large in the public health community. And so I think it's time to take a breath and avoid this sideshow circus, as you describe it, and really get back to the matters at hand, not just in the United States, where Ebola has gotten an awful lot of attention, but really there's only been four cases, but primarily in West Africa, where it is, you know, there's 13,000 or more cases and 4,000 or 5,000 deaths. And the real concern is that that will spread elsewhere, maybe in Africa or other areas, and particularly if it went to a poor urban area, Kinshasa or Calcutta or another place like that, where there's not a lot of health care and it could really spread even worse. That's the prize we have to keep our eyes on, not bicycle rides or Governor Christie doing this or that or this judge or doing that or the other. In my opinion.
Is how a germ is transmitted key to determining when there should be a quarantine and how long it should last?
Absolutely. And that, I think, is what a lot of the people who are so opposed to quarantine, and, you know, quarantine is you know, it's a sledgehammer of a tool, and if you could use a finer tool, you know, you can hammer a nail with a sledgehammer, but you could also do it with a little hammer as well. And it's very socially disruptive, and it's also very problematic and isolating and, you know, psychologically traumatic to an individual. And so Ebola, which is very specifically transmitted by body fluids, as I just described, is not nearly a good a case as, say, Spanish flu, as you mentioned, and quarantine was, in fact, used in the 1918 flu pandemic. And, you know, then there's been other cases. Do you remember early in the 1980s when some of the first cases in New York City and San Francisco of AIDS were coming out, even after the HIV virus was discovered and described, and the transmission was clearly by sexual activity or the commingling of blood and occasionally by maternal fetal transfer, there were people calling for the quarantine of gay men or intravenous drug users or Haitians. And that would be an absolute silly use of quarantine because you have to do very specific behaviors to contract that virus. So, you know, using it as a knee-jerk sledgehammer, particularly out of fear or panic or for political gain, I don't think is a very good use. And it really does have to be based on the science of virology. And so a lot of the guidelines, all the guidelines that the CDC recently released a few days ago, it's a very measured and layered approach depending on how high a risk you were exposed to the Ebola virus and what should be done.
In New York, we have North Brother Island,
yeah,
which is now abandoned. People were quarantined there for a number of different illnesses.
I know it well, and in fact, I've been on North Brother Island, and I promptly stepped on a nail the minute I got off the boat, so I had to get a tetanus shot after that.
But they weren't quarantined for tetanus.
No.
But for typhoid and leprosy?
Well, not leprosy, no. There weren't very many lepers in New York City at the time, but it was the quarantine island of the city of New York, so it was run by the New York City Health Department. There was also a specific hospital, the Willard Parker Hospital on East 16th Street, that would treat people with infectious diseases, especially childhood infectious diseases back in the teens. But the city quarantine island, they would send people out there for typhus fever, cholera, and most famously, Typhoid Mary lived there for many, many years.
Let's take a call. David from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. So quarantine is imposed by the government on a person for the public good. And my question is, why shouldn't that person be compensated by the public through the government for submitting to this onerous burden? I, as a New Yorker, for example, would be perfectly fine with the city government paying, compensating somebody $1,000 a day for submitting to a quarantine if they pose such a threat to our city.
Now, $1,000 a day is pretty good. That's $365,000 a year. I'll take that job.
Well, they wouldn't have to be quarantined for that long. So, I mean, maybe a different formula could come up with, but it should be. It's a pretty big burden, quarantine.
Yeah.
And we all would be benefiting from it, right? If that's not the case, why should they be quarantined?
And have people other than Nurse Hickox objected over the years, even if there was good reason?
Oh my, yes. It's from the first day's quarantine was ever ordered in the Middle Ages, today, those in quarantine objected vehemently. And particularly if you go back 100 or more years, it was enforced rather stringently. You didn't have a choice. You could not, maybe if you had a lawyer you could try, but it was very difficult to rescind that order. And this dates back to an ancient Roman law that basically the health of the many outweigh the health of the individual. But you also have to think, you know, particularly before World War II and especially before 1920, there wasn't any medication, really. There were no IV fluids. There wasn't a lot that doctors could offer for those who were infected with a disease like cholera or typhus. And so the thought was, well, those people will either not get the disease, or if they have the disease, their body will either fight it off successfully or they will die. And so there wasn't much thought to that individual as opposed to protecting the healthy city or community at large. Well, now in our modern era, we have wonderful medications and hospitals and in fact, even the American Ebola cases, the two nurses have been released and did, rather well. And I think that's a testament to American medicine. And also, particularly in the last 50 years, the notion of individual rights and civil rights and fighting authority has taken a much greater place in our society. And so people will complain about it. What I find fascinating about Ms. Hickox is that while she was in this tent without showering facilities and television, she somehow was given a computer and a Wi-Fi hotspot. So she wrote an op-ed for a Dallas newspaper that then spread throughout the media. And that's remarkable because in the olden days, if you were on North Brother Island, you had no communication with anybody. So that really changed the game entirely, I think, and this is a good example of it.
Going online is an epidemic of another sort. Edward from Manhattan, yeah. Hi, you're on the air.
Leonard, thanks for taking my call. I listened to your program with great interest for a long time. I listened to your program about quarantine. Well, I was born in Tanzania in East Africa, and I was at primary school in Arusha, and I got mumps, and I was sequestrated and lonely 3 weeks for mumps in 1950.
Dr. Markell, is 3 weeks for mumps a reasonable quarantining time?
Well, that has to do, too, with the incubation and infectivity period of mumps. And, now we rarely see mumps because of the mumps vaccine.
Yeah, the MMRs.
MMR, which is mumps, measles, and rubella, right. And it brings up, it's a separate issue. The quarantines that we're talking about with Ebola or cholera or when ships came in or at airports or even Venice, those were issues of germs in transit, so to speak, of spreading epidemics. Childhood diseases, on the other hand, as one of the previous callers noted, you really wanted to get that child away from other people, particularly children, because they could become ill. And you wanted to make sure that the families didn't spread it. Pertussis or whooping cough is a perfect example. Most kids who get it today are unvaccinated to begin with, and they contract it from adults who have a pertussis infection but don't have that whooping cough because they're too big. Their airways are too big to have that whooping cough. But fortunately, we don't see mumps or measles. In fact, I'm a pediatrician. I have never seen a case of mumps or measles or polio, for that matter, because in the United States particularly, we have prevented them entirely with these wonderful vaccines.
I'm old enough to have had measles and mumps and German measles, but I'm okay. At least I will never get them again. We have very little time. Susan from Staten Island, could you make it quick?
I'll try. It's my understanding that since Ebola was first discovered and labeled and separated in Africa, that the African way of treating it has been to take care of the initial patient and all of the initial contacts and quarantine all of those people for the three-week period, and it worked. And it also worked with this epidemic in Africa, with the Liberian man who went to Nigeria, and that's exactly what they did.
Well, Nigeria did it, but others have not done it. We have very little time. So Nigeria handled it correctly, Dr. Markell?
Well, they did, but you also have to note that those who got it in Nigeria were people from upper socioeconomic classes, professional classes, often physicians. And so they were all cooperative in working with the public health authorities. The issue, you're right,
we have to stop it there.
You want to break contact, basically, with people who are ill. That's
Dr. Howard Markell is the George E. Wants Distinguished Professor and Founding Director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. He has been our guest on today's Please Explain look at quarantining. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leonard.